Her husband, Dr. Donald Gibbs, and Mrs. Gibbs have had a long association with the United Methodist Church, and we've asked Mrs. Gibbs to tell us something of her career with the church and elsewhere. But Mrs. Gibbs, I think there isn't too much elsewhere, because I think your life has been pretty well dominated by the church.
That's true.
But let's start by telling us something about your early life.
Well, I was born on a farm in Christian County here in Illinois. My parents were farmers at that stage of their life. Then they bought a farm of their own, and we lived between Springfield and Decatur on a farm. I went to a country school for my grade school education, and then following grade school, I went to Iliopolis High School. Now, to get to high school in those days, you had to go on an interurban. You know the interurban, which is an electric means of transportation. And we lived within about 3/4 of a mile of an interurban stop. Of course, the interurban stopped at every crossroads. And so far, 2.5 years, I rode the interurban to school every morning and back every afternoon, and would walk to our farm from the station. Then in December of 1918, my family moved here to Decatur. They thought there would be more educational advantages for their children if they lived in Decatur. And so we moved here, and I entered Decatur High School in January of 1919. And I joined the First Methodist Church at that time, and knew the church at that period of my life. And I graduated from Decatur High School in 1920. But I somehow, through a high school teacher, got interested in Northwestern University. And I went off to university at Evanston and didn't go to Millikan, as my folks had thought would happen. And I'm glad I did, because it broadened my horizon greatly to have had the experience up on the Evanston campus. Then following, I was very active in the First Methodist Church in Evanston. The students had quite a program there, and I was interested in that. And because of my activities in that student group in the church, the bishop of the Chicago area recommended me for a job out at Ypsilanti, Michigan, which was working with students. And so when I graduated from Northwestern, I went out to Ypsilanti, which is near Ann Arbor. And the college there then was called a teacher's college. I think it's now Eastern Michigan University. And so I was in Michigan at Ypsilanti for 2 years. Now, in the meantime, while I was at Northwestern, I came to know Donald Gibbs, and we were married in 26 after I had been up there for 2 years. Now, you want something about my husband. His father, of course, was a Methodist minister. He was born in Charleston when his father was serving that church. And he lived here in Decatur about 1901, when his father served our church, First Church, as an interim pastor before Dr. Davidson came. And Dr. Davidson was the man who built the present building. That is, he was the pastor while the building was being built. And then my husband graduated from Decatur High School, and had 2 years at Millikan, which was during the First World War. They had a student army training corps there, of which he was a part. But the war was over and then he went to Northwestern University, and it was on the campus at Northwestern that we came to know each other. Then he went off to Japan. Following his graduation from Northwestern, he went to Japan on a two-year contract, selected by the International Committee of the YMCA. The Japanese government needed persons to teach conversational English to their students, and so they asked the International Committee of the YMCA to select six young men to come and be the teachers in conversational English. And my husband was a part of this group of six men who went out to teach, and was in Japan from 22 to 24. And when he returned home in 24, and incidentally, he was in Japan during the great earthquake of September 1923. He was not injured. He happened to be up in the mountains at a retreat. They were living in a Buddhist monastery, which was about the safest place to be for an earthquake, and there were not many effects of the earthquake up in that area in Japan. Well, when he came home in 1924, he served a year as associate pastor at First Church here in Decatur, and then he went to Garrett Theological Seminary in Evanston to get theological training, and we were married in 1926, and lived in Evanston the last year of his theological schooling. Now, we came back to Decatur in 1931, and he was assigned to serve the Cleveland Avenue Methodist Church. Now, that was the heart of the Depression, as you may remember, and the Cleveland Avenue Church served a working class people, and they were very hard hit by the Depression. He often jokingly remarked that he had to retype his membership list about every month because people had to make living arrangements in the light of their financial circumstances, and they had to change. A man from First Church who helped us a great deal during that period was Dr. E.T. Evans, who was a dentist here in Decatur, and he was quite a character. Mrs. Evans was a very fine person too, for that matter, but Dr. Evans was very helpful with my husband during that Depression period. And it was while we were living in that parsonage that the Decatur District Woman's Foreign Missionary Society needed a president. And Mrs. A.M. Wells, now the mother of John Wells and Art Wells, was on the nominating committee, and she was the person who came to see me to get me to do this job. Of course, I was very young and inexperienced and didn't know too much about it, but I took it on, and that was my first introduction to the women's work of the church. Now, it was possible for me to do it at that period of time because our son was about 3 or 4 years old then, and my mother was living here in Decatur, and she liked to have him stay with her, and he liked to stay with her, so that when I went to meetings, it was possible for him to stay with his grandmother. And so that's how I worked it out during that period of time. But that was my introduction to the women's work of the church. And then we left Decatur in 1935 and went to Gibson City. And I did not pick up with the district work then. I was involved in other ways. But by 1939, when the Methodist Church, our Methodist Church, and the Methodist Church South, and the Methodist Protestant Church came into union in 1939 to form the Methodist Church. Now, the break had come for two different reasons. The break to form the Methodist Protestant Church came much earlier in the history over the issue of bishops. The Methodist Protestant Church felt that the bishops were exercising too much authority, that the lay people of the church didn't have a vote or a say in the work of the church. So they withdrew, and they never to form the Methodist Protestant Church, and they were centered in Maryland. That was one of their centers. And then the other break was between the Northern Methodist and the Southern Methodist over the issue of slavery. And that was prior to the Civil War. Well, now these three groups came together in 1939 to form the Methodist Church. And at that time, it was a part of the plan of union that the women's organizations of the church would also unite to form the Woman's Society of Christian Service. And it meant in our church that the Woman's Foreign Missionary Society and the Woman's Home Missionary Society and the Wesleyan Service Guild, which was for business and professional women, and the Ladies' Aid organization all became one organization. And it was really really a big effort that to bring all these organizations together into one organization. So I was a part of the conference group that worked on that, and I was elected the vice president for the first election. I think I remember I also was a part of the delegates that went to a jurisdictional meeting. Now, one of the compromises that had to be made in order to have a united church was that the church was divided in jurisdictions, which meant that the old Confederate states could be autonomous in some regards. And all the black folks in the Methodist Church were put into one jurisdiction called the Central Jurisdiction. Now, many people came to feel that that was a wrong compromise to have made. But in 39, it was the best that could be done. Because that compromise brought about some racial discrimination. Well, we were a part of the North Central Jurisdiction, and the plan was to elect so many women to be a member of the National Board, and I was a part of that first body that elected nominees. Really what it was electing nominees. So that was experience for me. Well, I served 3 years as a vice president of the conference, and felt that that was enough, and that would have been 44, I guess. And then it must have been 1950, I was elected to serve in the Jurisdiction Woman's Society, in an office in the Jurisdiction Woman's Society. And that was the first experience that I had outside of the bounds of the conference, because that was composed of, I think, 9 or 10 states here in this region. And you went to meetings in Chicago or Milwaukee or Minneapolis or Columbus or Cincinnati. it broadened my vision considerably. And I served in that capacity for about 7 years, and then went from that in 1956, was elected to a member of the National Board. And I serve as a member of the National Board for 12 years, three quadrennia. Now you, I think, asked something about the School of Christian Mission. That goes back to my experience as a district president in the early 1930s. I came to know about an institute that was held at Camp Milan, which is still in existence, south of Rock Island is the location for it, that the women in that district were having an institute. And I think some of us from Decatur went up to that institute. And we worked out a cooperative arrangement between the Decatur district and the Bloomington district and the Champaign district. This would have been the Women's Foreign Missionary Society now. To have an institute in which our women would come and learn about the mission study program and so forth. And so it was at that period of time that we established an institute in this part of the conference. And it continued. And when the Woman Society of Christian Service came into existence in 1939, then the responsibility for these institutes became the conference responsibility, and it was called a School of Christian Mission at that time. And
may I ask you a question about these institutes? How long did they last?
Well, it's my remembrance, without looking up some of the material I've kept, that lasted 3 or 4 days, usually in the middle of a week, not over a weekend.
What did you do there?
Well, we brought in leaders from outside the conference who sort of coached us in the mission the mission textbook and how to present a study, and then we also had workshops on how the work of the local organization and so forth. And there were missionaries who were brought to the institute to inspire us and so forth.
Did you study a specific topic at each institute?
Yes. The church as a whole had the study program in which for this year we will study this and that, and we would
foreign country.
Foreign country, and then I think we've always had a Bible study along with it too, so that there were several types of emphases to follow. And then with missionaries present on the ground, you would be interested in their activities, and so they would be persons who were home on furlough, assuming they were foreign missionaries. It was always harder to get home missionaries present in the institutes or the schools, later in schools, because we were nearer to their place of work and they needed to be on the job, and that's still true today. My connection with the School of Christian Mission, as a member of the conference committee that planned it each year, I had a long relationship with that committee from the beginning of the school until I retired from the membership of the Board of Missions in 1968. The women really just invited me to serve on that committee. There was no reason why I should have been on the committee, but because of my long association with it. So I was a part of the planning for 25 years or more.
Now, I think you mentioned that all of these, or you should mention that all of these jobs were volunteer jobs.
Yes, I should make this quite clear, because this is volunteer work. We did get expenses for travel. That is to say, if you were on the railroad, your railroad ticket was paid for. If you and in the latter years, you flew by plane because when the passenger trains were discontinued, and you got your plane ticket. And if you stayed at a hotel, you got your expense for hotel room and the expense for your meals that you purchased. But other than that, you were a volunteer. And my husband often jokingly remarked that I did as much work at home in my den typing as his secretary did at the office, but it was solely a volunteer proposition. And I think the strength of the women's organization in the church over the years has been because of this volunteer work. It has reduced the overhead expenses of the organization considerably because you had volunteers carrying responsibility for the organization that professional people didn't have to do, assuming professional people are on salary. Now, when I became a, I think that I should say that during my 7 years as a jurisdiction officer, my horizon was broadened considerably, and I began going to meetings. It was a plan of the structure in those days that a jurisdiction officer came to a woman's division committee meeting once a year, and that would bring you in touch with women from all over the country, and you became familiar with the Southern woman and the Western woman, and we do have certain different characteristics from the various sections of the country that we come from, and you realize that decisions have to be made by compromises because we don't all think alike. And that was a good introduction to my membership on the board, which is a national body. That is, its membership is nationwide. And then during this jurisdiction experience, we had seminars held every few years, which broadened your horizon of current social problems. And I was, at that time, the particular responsibility I had was in the area of Christian social relations. And that was a very broadening experience. And I came to know some of the black women of the church and went to some of their meetings, and that meant that I went onto campuses that were traditionally Negro college campuses, and I went into parts of the country that were where the blacks were predominant, and it was a very broadening experience for me. It opened my eyes to a good many things. I remember, this is sort of a humorous anecdote, at least I look at it that way. I was down in Jackson, Tennessee, where there is a school predominantly for black students, and I was traveling by railroad, and I went into the station to pick up my ticket, and I did not realize that there were two entrances to the railroad station, the black entrance and the white entrance, and I came in the wrong way. I didn't know any better.
Were you told?
These experiences as a officer of the Jurisdiction Woman Society prepared me for membership on the national board. The national board in my day, every woman was a member of the woman's division, and then she served also on either the national division or the world division. My first quadrennia, I served on the national division as well as the woman's division. And then the last two quadrennia, I served on the world division. I found that more interesting in many ways. Your responsibilities on the national board depend greatly on your committee assignments. And I found that I had more and more and more and more committees as time went on. I happened to fall into the Committee on Constitution and Bylaws when I first went to the board, that is the Woman's Division Committee. And these were years when there was restructuring taking place. And I became chairman of the committee in my second quadrennia. And that just took me into more and more and more detail work. And there were more and more structural changes involved. And until finally, the last quadrennia, I really carried a terrific load. For between 64 and 68 was when we had the merger with the United Brethren, Evangelical United Brethren Church. Now, it was a very unequal sort of a union because the Methodists were about 10 million members, and the Evangelical United Brethren Church was a church of about 650,000 members. But every aspect of the structure of the new church was rethought in the light of this union. So you had to go over everything. And with the women's work, that is, we had to do it from the beginning. And it meant innumerable committee meetings, traveling here and there. And I think I should say here that whereas I lived at home here in Decatur, and my husband was responsibility was with the Preacher's Aid Society, and I had no children at home, and he was willing for me to do it so that I could be gone. But I never tried to be away on weekends, because that was when he was home and I felt I needed to be here, unless it was just absolutely necessary.
May I ask you a question? You speak of quadrennium. For the ordinary person, how long a time is that?
That's four years.
4 years.
We do, in the Methodist Church, even today, we do things by fours. The General Conference meets every 4 years, and every part of the church is organized for a four-year period, and then new members are elected, and you have another 4 years.
Now, you were with this, with the National Board for years then.
12 years.
Now, did you, and you traveled from here to New York?
Yes, and everywhere else. because we had committee meetings. It was unfair to bring everyone to New York every time, because there are people living in Texas, mm-hmm. and California and what have you. And so we had committee meetings in various places. Now, I remember going quite a few times to Atlanta, quite a few times to Cincinnati, and I think I went out to Denver several times for committee meetings. That is so we would make it more even for the Western women to come to a committee meeting. They wouldn't have to do all the traveling clear across the continent.
You weren't working all the time, were you? I mean, every week.
No. It would. I wish now that I had kept a record of where I traveled and when I traveled, but it didn't seem important at the time. I suppose I could go back through my date books and figure it out, but I don't know if there's any point. But and then I taught during these years. I taught in schools. I felt that I had a responsibility to give as well as to receive, and so I taught in a couple of schools of Christian mission every summer, mostly in our jurisdiction, which meant that I went to Minnesota or Wisconsin or Michigan or Ohio or Indiana or Iowa. Let's see, what other states do we have? I went to Pennsylvania one summer, but it was mostly within our own jurisdiction where I taught. And that was a good experience in the conference schools. I did that for 20 years, from 1950 to 1970. My first school was in Iowa, and my last school was in Iowa. So that was sort of, I began and ended in the same state, conference school.
Now you continue this teaching even in our own church.
Yes. They're remarkably appropriate many times. This year we have a study on South Pacific, the peoples of the South Pacific. Next year, that is the year 1984, the study will be on refugees around the world. Or a study on certain countries in Africa. Always we have a Bible study. I think our church usually makes that a part of some other studies that they are having, perhaps during Lent. Leaders of classes in local churches really get much help if they attend the Conference School of Christian Mission each summer. It's held up at Bloomington. Men and women are welcome, and they are the persons who teach those classes have had some wider experiences, and it introduces you to the subject matter and resource materials and any personal experiences people may have had. And it's really a good coaching experience. I often jokingly remark it's where I get new ideas, because I come in contact with people I don't ordinarily come in contact with. Now, not every church follows this study plan, but it is one of the strengths of the women's organization that we have promoted the study all during for 50 years at least. When study classes are held in a local church, anyone is welcome to attend, men or women or young people. We usually, the class has been held on a morning in recent years in our church, and of course that has excluded people that are employed, but that's been the choice of the women. And of course, not many men have attended, and time and again we have felt that the men of our church should be a part of the study group, but we would need to have it at another time, I think, for that to be effective. In the early years, that is, from about 71 to the late 70s, the Wesleyan Service Guild, which existed in our church, had a study in the fall, and I, for a number of years, would lead two different study classes, one for the Wesleyan Service Guild and then one at another season of the year for other women in the church. The Wesleyan Service Guild was for business and professional women. As time went by, the distinction between business and professional women and the rest of the women in the church ceased to exist, because so many of the women were employed in outside the home. And so I think in the early 1970s, or no, I can't think when it was, that the Wesleyan Service Guild ceased to exist. It's now a Circle Six. The women that were in that group are now Circle Six of our church, of our society, or unit, I guess I should say.
Why don't you tell us something about the history of the women's group at the First Methodist Church, and some of the women who had played a part, an outstanding role in that group?
Well, my memory goes back to my high school days, which would be around 1920, because I graduated from Decatur High School in 1920. I remember vividly Mrs. R.C. Augustine, who was a member of our church and a very active woman in the community. She served on the school board, Decatur School Board, for many, many years. She was a woman that had a remarkable vision for her day and generation. And Mrs. Lucy Opplinger was her daughter, her oldest daughter. And Lucy, in turn, served as a member of our Decatur School Board for many years. So she was really a very remarkable woman. I think of Mrs. Marksmiller. Now, Mrs. Marksmiller's been gone for many years, but her husband was I think he was a dentist, but I could be wrong as to what his occupation was. But she was a very active woman in our church. I think of Mrs. E.T. Evans. And when you go into our lounge or library, as we, whichever you call it, those frescoes on the wall were gotten for the church by Mrs. Evans. She was a woman from Maryland, Fredericksburg, Maryland, and she was a very remarkable woman who liked to have the church look well.
Mrs. Conklin, you mentioned.
Yes, our messenger this week has a article about our chimes, which were given in 1910 by Mrs. Conklin. Now, I never knew Mrs. Conklin as a woman, as a person, but my husband's aunt was a good friend of Mrs. Conklin's. Mrs. Conklin was active in the Conference Women's Home Missionary Society, and she and my husband's aunt were very close friends. She was quite a remarkable woman, with great deal of leadership ability, and of course she made a handsome bequest to us in the chimes. I was quite impressed at their monetary valuation today. It's a good thing we have them, because we would never get them today at the price they are. Our church has always produced good leaders for the district and conference organization. Of course, in more recent years, Harriet Ellis and Imogene Brown have served in the district and conference organization. There have been other women over the years that have also served in the district and conference organization.
Of course, our local women's group, the First United Methodist Women's Group, had followed the same pattern in the history as the other groups, that is, joining of the various units. Maybe you could explain what the Ladies' Aid, for example, and the, of course, the Foreign Missions is rather self-explanatory, but what did these individual groups, what were their special functions or plans?
Well, of course, the Woman's Foreign Missionary Group was formed to send missionaries overseas because they felt that there was need not only for men missionaries, but for women missionaries, because in many countries, men had no contacts with any of the women. It just, the culture just did not permit it. So there was a need for women missionaries, and that is how the women got involved, because the first little group of eight women that came together to form the Woman's Foreign Missionary Society in Boston sent out Isabella Thoburn and Clara Swain to India. Miss Thoburn was a teacher and Dr. Swain was a medical doctor. And today we have in India the Isabella Thoburn College and the Clara Swain Hospital, which date back to the work of those, the pioneer work of those women. Now, the Home Missionary Society came into being after the Civil War because there were areas in which the church was not serving, particularly providing educational opportunities for the black children that were recently emancipated. The slaves were given their freedom at the time of the Civil War, and there were black children that had no educational opportunities. There were also mountain children, children that grew up in the Appalachian Mountains that did not have educational opportunities. And that was another concern of the women. Then this was an era when many, many immigrants were coming to the United States. At the port of entries for these immigrants, the Woman's Home Missionary Society established residences for the young girls who came without any families. They established community centers to help orient the people that came from another land into this country. And then they even had an interest in the children up in Alaska. When John Schaefer talked to our unit recently, he talked about the Jesse Lee Home. The origin of that goes back to 1890, when the Woman's Home Missionary Society was concerned about the Eskimo and Indian children who lost their parents. In those years, children were left orphans by the death of one or both of their parents, and so the Jesse Lee Home was established to take care of these orphan children. It's amazing the wide concerns that the women had in those years to establish educational and community centers and medical needs of these people who were coming to our shores.
What about the Ladies' Aid Society?
Yes, now that, of course, the Ladies' Aid Society goes back to the beginning of the church, because the Bible tells us about some of the women who worked in the church in those days, because the women have always been interested in how their church looked and how the work, the program of the church progressed, and they really were an aid society in the work of the church, concerned with the appearance of the church building and innumerable ways in which you can make the work of the church, local church, more effective.
Did women belong to more than one of these groups?
Yes, they did. There came to be some competition, and I say that advisedly, between the Woman's Home Missionary Society and the Woman's Foreign Missionary Society. But that was a minor matter in many instances. But many women would belong to the Ladies' Aid Society as well as one of the missionary societies.
But under the reorganization, then they all do part of the work of all groups.
We do the whole emphases now in one organization, and of course the Methodist Church South began this union longer before we did in our part of the church. So it came hard to us in 1940 to have just one woman's organization, but the rest of the church had had it previously to that time. And it was hard for our local women. I was a part of the church, our local church, from 1944 to 1950 when my husband was the district superintendent. And that was near to the beginning of the Woman Society of Christian Service. And it wasn't easy to make the change and shift your loyalties and allegiance to the Woman Society of Christian Service.
Now, I know that the women may earn considerable amount of money, and the allocation of funds goes back to these various needs, doesn't it?
In our local church, at the time of the forming of the Woman Society of Christian Service, a study was made of the giving of the predecessor organizations, the Woman's Home Missionary Society and the Woman's Foreign Missionary Society and the Ladies' Aid. And that is how we established for the Woman Society of Christian Service that two-thirds of our money would go for missions and one-third for the local church, because that was the proportion of the giving at the time of union. And we have followed that allocation ever since until just recently. I think we may have voted to certain monies would be divided 50-50, but it was based on our history of giving that it was established two-thirds and one-third in 1940.
Mrs. Gibbs, you mentioned a few minutes ago about your husband's duties as district superintendent. Maybe we could go back and tell a little bit about what it was like to be a district superintendent and the wife of a district superintendent.
Well, it was an interesting experience. The geography of our district entered into a good deal of our travel, because in those days the Decatur district was a rectangle, rectangular shaped, and Decatur was in the northwest corner, which meant that to travel to Paris or to Marshall or Casey, you had a long distance to travel. I think it was 90 miles to Marshall or Casey. And after our son graduated from high school in 1946, that would have been the old Decatur High School, he went away to college, and I had no family responsibilities to keep me in Decatur. So I went along with my husband when he went out of town. And it was a good experience for both of us. It it gave us a companionship, and when he had to travel home after a quarterly conference, as we called it in those days, I think at night, that he didn't have to travel alone. We also used the highway from Lovington to Paris a good deal. Now that highway, I think it's called 133, goes right through the Amish community, and I always had a fear that we would hit one of those Amish buggies in nighttime driving, because you don't always see the lights that they have on those buggies. But we never had an accident. The only accident we ever had was that we hit a hog that was on the highway one night, and it was a large hog, and the bristles left marks on the paint of the car. So I don't remember what happened to the hog, but we had marks of the bristles on the paint of the car. That was in another area. It wasn't in the Amish community. But my husband really liked driving home at night after an evening quarterly conference. He said it rested him. And there were only a couple times that he ever asked me to take the wheel and drive the car in, that he was too tired to drive it. I always remember coming to 36 east from Decatur, there at La Place, I think, when we would come to that intersection. It was just 13 miles then into Decatur. And it always seemed as if we were nearly home when we got to that intersection. Of course, we didn't go every day, but we did go frequently at certain times of the year. Because in those days, you had a quarterly conference at every church, certainly every charge. And there were about 90 churches within the district in those days. Not that many charges, of course. Some pastors would have more than one church to serve.
Mrs. Gibbs, you certainly have, your life has just been tied in with the United Methodist Church, and you have, you said something a while ago about giving and getting, but you certainly have done your share of giving to the church in many, many ways, as the minister's wife, as the district superintendent's wife, and on your own as a real career, with your work with Board of Missions and so on. Now, you have viewed many changes in the church. Could you sum up a little bit about how you feel about that?
Well, I have seen many changes, and I don't regret change. I think that it's a sign of growth and development. We shouldn't remain static and do things just the same way as we always have. And personally, I'm ready for change if there's a good reason for it. And I think the church will continue to change and develop and grow in the light of the needs of the time, because our insight changes as time goes on, and maybe it is better insight than it was previously.
And women can be proud of helping to advance those changes?
Yes, many times women are the instigators. They may not get the credit for it, but they many times are the reason for bringing about change. You can take the racial issue in the church for one thing. I spoke some time back about the central jurisdiction coming into being. It was the women who took the initiative to have integrated meetings when the rest of the church was having racially segregated meetings. And we have often been the leaders in a cause many times.
Well, I think, Mrs. Gibbs, you can be very proud to think that you have helped to advance the cause, and we certainly appreciate all of the work you have done for the church in as a whole, and also for the local United Methodist Women Unit at the First United Methodist Church. We thank you very, very much for sharing your experiences with us.
Well, it has been an enriching experience for me. I have gained personally far more than anything that I may have given, I'm sure.
Well, thank you. You have been listening to the reminiscences of Mrs. Ruth Gibbs, and this is Betty Turnell.